Chapter 9, Louisiana Two-Step. "The world was always a mysterious dream to me," she had told him, "but now it is an incomprehensible nightmare. Was it like this for those Jews, do you think?" Which Jews? He had never had much interest in anthropology. She had continued speaking, probably to herself, as she stood on the balcony of the hotel in Gatlinburg and watched the aftershocks of some passing skirmish billow over the horizon. Those folk, those Anglo-Saxons, had no special comfort in dying. Not for them the zealotry of the Viking or the Moor. They paraded their iron and their horses, and they made compacts with those they conquered or who threatened them. They offered a return to a Roman golden age, a notion of universal justice, and they gradually prevailed until chaos was driven into darkness and ancient memory. Even the Normans could not reverse what the Anglo-Saxons achieved. But with that achievement, Jack, also vanished a certain wild vivacity, what the Christians came to call pagan. She had sighed and kissed his hands, looking away at that flickering ginger moon. "Do you long for those times, Jack? That pagan dream?" Mr. Carquazian thought it astonishing that anyone had managed to create a kind of order out of ungovernable chaos, and that, though he would never say so, was his reason for believing in God, and also, because logic would have it, the old hunter. Total consciousness must, I suppose, suggest total anti-consciousness and all that lies between. She told him then of her own belief. If the fault were manifest evil, then somewhere there must be an equivalent manifestation of good. She loved life with a positive relish, which he enjoyed vicariously, and which in turn restored to him sensibilities long since atrophied. When he left the steamboat at Greenville, Mr. Carquazian brought himself a sturdy riding horse and made his way steadily up the trace, determined to admire and relish the beauty of it as if for the first time. Once again, many of the trees had already dropped their leaves. Through their skeletons, a faint pink-gold wash in the pearly sky showed the position of the sun. Against this cold, soft light, the details of the trees were emphasized, giving each twig a character of its own. Jack Carquazian kept his mind on those wonders and pleasures, moving day by day towards McClellan and the silver cypress swamp, the gold stains. In the sharp, new air, he felt a strength that he had not known, even before his act of infamy. Perhaps it was a hint of redemption. Of his several previous attempts to return, he had no clear recollections, but this time, though he anticipated forgetfulness, as it were, he was more confident of his momentum. In his proud heart, his sinner's heart, he saw Kalinda de Vero as the means of his salvation. She alone would give him a choice which might redeem him in his eyes, if not in God's. She was still his luck. She would be back at her stains, he thought, maybe working her claim, a rich machine baron herself by now and unsettled by his arrival. But once united, he knew they could be parted only by an act of uncalled for courage, perhaps something like a martyrdom. He felt she was offering him at last a destiny. Mr. Carquazian rode up on the red gold trace between the tall, dense trees of the Mississippi woods, crossing the broken and new rivers, following the joyfully foaming Pearl for a while, until he was in Choctaw country, where he paid his toll in Peel's Noirs to an unsmiling Indian who had not seen, he said, a good horse in a long time. He spoke of an outrage, an automobile which had come by a few days ago, driven by a woman with auburn hair. He pointed. The deep tire tracks were still visible. Mr. Carquazian began to follow him, guessing that Kalinda de Vero had left them for him. At what enormous cost? It seemed she must already be tapping the stains. Such power would be worth almost anything when war eventually came. He could feel the disintegration in the air. Soon these people would be mirroring the metaphysical destruction by falling upon and devouring their fellows. Yet through their self-betrayal, he thought, Kalinda de Vero might survive and even prosper, at least for a while. He arrived in McClellan expecting to find change, enrichment from the colour strike. But the but the town remains the pleasant, unaltered place he had known, her maze of old railroad tracks crossing and recrossing at dozens of intersections. From the pre-Biloxi days, when the meat plants had made her rich, her people friendly and easy, her whites respectful yet dignified. Jack Caraquasian spent the night at the Henry Clay Hotel and was disappointed to find no one in the tidy little main street, now a far cry from its glory, who had heard of activity out around the streams. Only a fool, he was told, would go into that cypress swamp at any time of year, least of all during a true season. Consoling himself with the faint hope that she might have kept her workings a secret, Mr. Caraquasian rented himself a pirogue, gave an eager Kittikin a guinea to take care of his horse, and set off into the streams, needing no map, no memory, merely his will and the unreasoning certainty that she was drawing him to her. Chapter 10, Sugar Bee. I had been dying all my life, Jack, she had said. I decided I wanted to live. I'm giving it my best shot. If we are here as a result of an accident, let us take advantage of that. The swamp fog obscured all detail. There was the sharp sound of the water as he paddled the pirogue, the rustle of a wing, a muffled rush, a faint shadow moving amongst the trunks. Jack Caraquasian began to wonder if he were not in limbo, moving from one matrix to another. Would those outlines remain the outlines of trees and vines? Would they crystallize, perhaps, to become massive cliffs of basalt and obsidian? There was sometimes a clue in the nature of the echoes. He whistled a snatch of Grand Mamou, the old dance tune, helped his spirits. He believed he must still be in the same reality. Human love, Jack, is our only weapon against chaos, and yet consistently we reject its possibilities in favour of some more abstract and therefore less effective notion. Suddenly, through the agitated grey, as if in confirmation of his instinct, a dozen ibises winged low beneath the branches of the cypresses and cedars, as silvery as bass, so that Mr. Caraquasian, in his scarlet travelling cloak, felt an intruder on all that exquisite paleness. When at last the sun began to wash across the west and the mist was touched with the subtle colours of the tea rose, warming and dissipating, to reveal the tawny browns and dark greens it had been hiding, he grew more certain that this time, inevitably, he and Kalinda de Vero must reunite. He was half prepared to see the baroque brass and diamonds of the legendary Prosses, milking the stains for his sweetheart's security. But only herons disturbed the covering of leaves upon the water. Only ducks and perpetua geese shouted and bickered in the cold air, the rapid flutter of their wings bearing eerie resemblance to a mechanish engine. The cypress swamp was avoided by men, was genuinely timeless, perhaps the only place on earth completely unaffected by the Biloxi era. Why would such changelessness be feared? Or had fundamental change already occurred? Something too complex and delicate for the human brain to comprehend, just as it could not really accept the experience of more than one matrix. Jack Caraquasian, contented by the swamp's familiarity, did not wish to challenge its character. Instead, he drew further strength from it, so that when, close to twilight, he saw the apparently ramshackle cabin, its blackened logs and blanks 2 stories high, riveted together by old salt and grit cans that still advertised the virtues of their ancient brands, and perched low in the fork of 2 great silvery cypress branches overhanging the water in the smallest of the stains, he knew at once that she had never truly left her claim, that in some way she had always been there waiting for him. For a few seconds, Jack Caraquasian allowed himself the anguish of regret and self-accusation. Then he threw back his cloak, cupped his hands around his mouth, and with his white breath pouring into the air, called out, Kalinda! And from within her fortress, her nest, she replied, Jack. She was leaning out over the veranda of woven branches, her almond eyes the colour of honey, bright with tears and hope, and understanding that this time, perhaps for the first time, he had actually made it back to her. He was no longer a ghost. When she spoke to him, however, her language was incomprehensible, seemingly a cacophony without melody or sense. Terrible yelps and groans burst out of her perfect lips. He could scarcely bear to listen. Is this, he wonders, how we first perceive the language of angels? The creosoted timbers lay in odd marriage to the pale branches which cradled them, flitting with urgent joy from veranda to branch and from branch to makeshift ladder. She was a tawny spirit. Naked, yet unaffected by the evening chill, she reached the landing she had made. The planks, firmly moored by four oddly plaited ropes tied into the branches, rolled and bounced under her tiny bare feet. Jack, my pover hobo, it was as if she could only remember the language through snatches of song, as a child does. Ma pover Piero, she smiled in delight. He stepped from the pirogue to the landing. They embraced, scarlet engulfing dark gold. It was the resolution he had so often prayed for, but without redemption. For now it was even clearer to him that the mistake he had made at the Breed Papoose had never been an honest one. He also knew that she need never discover this, and what was left of the hypocrite in him called to him to forget the past as irredeemable. And when she sensed his tension, a hesitation, she asked in halting speech if he had brought bad news, if he no longer loved her, if he faltered. She had waited for him a long time, she said, relinquishing all she had gained so that she might be reunited with him, to take him with her, to show him what she had discovered in the stain. She drew him up to her cabin. It looked as if it had been here for centuries. It seemed in places to have grown into or from the living tree. Inside it was full of magpie luxury, plush and brass and gold-plated candelabra, mirrors and crystals and flowing muralos. There was a little power from the stains, she said, but not much. She had brought everything in the car long ago. She took him onto the veranda and, through the semi-darkness, pointed out the burgundy carcass of an antique Oldsmobile. I thought... But he was unable either to express the emotion he felt, or to comprehend the sickening temporal shifts which had almost separated them forever. It was as if a dream in reality had at last resolved, but at the wrong moment. Some men took you to Aberdeen. They were kind. Her speech was still thick. So I understand. But mistaken. I had returned to find you. I went into the stain while you were gone. When I tried to seek you out, I had forgotten how to speak or wear clothes. I got back here easily. It's never hard for me. Very hard for me. He embraced her again, kissed her. This is what I longed for. She studied his dark green eyes, his smooth brown skin, the contours of his face, his disciplined body. Waiting in this place has not been easy, with the world so close. But I came back for you, Jack. I believe the stain is not a sign of colour, but a kind of counter-effect to the fault. It leads to a cosmos of wonderful stability. Not stasis, they say, but with a slower rate of entropy. What they once called a lower chaos factor when I studied physics. I met a woman whom I think we would call the Rose in our language. She is half human, half flower, like all her race, and she was my mentor as she could be yours. And we could have children, Jack. It's an extraordinary adventure. So many ways of learning to see and so much time for it. Time for consideration. Time to create justice. Here, Jack, all the time is going. You know that. She sensed some unexpected resistance in him. She touched his cheek. Jack, we're on the edge of chaos here. We must eventually be consumed by what we created, but we also created a way out. What you always talked about, what you yearned for, you know. Yes, I know. Perhaps she was really describing heaven. He made an awkward gesture. Through there, he indicated in the gathering darkness, the pale wash of the nearest stain. The big one only. She became enthusiastic, her uncertainties fading before the vividness of her remembered experience. We have responsibilities. We have duties there, and they are performed naturally, clearly, from self-interest. There's understanding and charity there, Jack. The logic is what you used to talk about, when and what you thought you had dreamed, where chance no longer rules unchecked. It's a heavenly place, Jack. The rose will accept us both. She'll guide us. We can go there now if you like. You must want to go, mon chéri, mon chéri. But now, as she looked at him, at the way he stood, at the way he stared, unblinking, down into the swamp, she hesitated. She took his hand and gripped it. You want to go. It isn't boring, Jack. It's as real as here. But they have a future, a precedent. We have neither. I would like to find such a place. He checked the spasm in his chest and was apologetic. But I might not be ready, ma fancy. She held tight to his gambler's hand, wondering if she had misjudged its strength. You would rather spend your last days at a table in the terminal cafe, waiting for the inevitable moment of oblivion? I would rather journey with you, he said, to paradise, or anywhere you wished, Kalinda. But paradise will accept you, Mahani. Perhaps I have not yet earned my place there. She preferred to believe he joked with her. We will leave it until the morning. She stroked his blue-black hair, believing him too tired to think. There's no such thing as earning. It's always luck, Jack. It was luck we found the stains. It's luck that brought us together, brought us our love. Our love brought us back together. It is a long, valuable life they offer us, mon papillon, full of hope and peace. Take your chance, Jack, as you always did. He shook his head. But some of us, my love, have earning natures. I made a foolish play. I am ashamed. No regrets, Jack. You can leave it all behind. This is luck, our luck. What is it in you, Jack, this new misery? She imagined another woman. He could not tell her. He wanted the night with her. He wanted a memory. And her own passion for him conquered her curiosity, her trepidation. Yet there was a desperate quality to her lovemaking which neither she nor he had ever wished to sense again. Addressing this, she was optimistic. This will all go once we enter the stain. Doesn't it seem like heaven, Jack? Near enough, he admitted. A part of him, a bitter part of him, wished that he had never made this journey, that he had never left the game behind. For the game, even at its most dangerous, was better than the scarcely bearable pain. Oh, my heart. For the rest of the night, he savoured every second of his torment, and yet in the morning he knew that he was not by this means to gain release from his pride. It seemed that his self-esteem, his stern wall against the truth, crumbled in unison with the world's collapse. He saw for himself nothing but an eternity of anguished regret. Come. She moved towards sadness as she led him down through the branches and the timbers to his own pirogue. She refused to believe she had waited only for this. He let her row them out into the pastel brightness of the lagoon until they floated above the big gold stain, steering through that purity of colour as if they might actually glimpse the paradise she had described. Your clothes will go away. She was as gentle as a Louisiana April. You needn't worry about that. She slipped over the side and, with a peculiar lifting motion, moved under the membrane to hang against the density of the gold, smiling up to him to demonstrate that there was nothing to fear. As beautiful as she could ever be, as perfect as the colour. And then she had re-emerged in the shallow water amongst the lilies and the weeds and the sodden leaves. Come, Jack, you must not hurt me further, sweetheart. We will go now. But if you stay, I shall not return. Horrified by what she understood as his cowardice, She fell back against the stain, staring up at the silver grey branches of the big trees, watching the morning sun touch the rising mist, refusing to look at Jack Karakwazian while he wept for his failures, for his inability to seize this moment, for all his shame, his unforgotten dreams, at his unguessable loss. She spoke from the water. "It wasn't anything that happened to me down there turned me crazy. It was the journey here did that. It's sane down there, Jack." "Well, no place for a gambler then," he said, and laughed suddenly. "What is this compensatory heaven? What proof is there that it's real? The only reason for its existence appears to be a moral one." "It's balance," she said. "Nature offers balances." "That was always a human illusion. Look at Biloxi. There's the reality. I'm not ready." "This isn't worthy of you, Jack." She was frightened now, perhaps doubting everything. "I'm not your Jack," he told her. "Not any longer. I can't come yet. You go on, ma chérie. I'll join you if I can. I'll follow you. But not yet." She put her fingers on the edge of the boat. She spoke with soft urgency. "It's hard for me, Jack. I love you. You're growing old here." She reached up her arms, the silver water falling upon his clothes as if to drag him with her. She gripped his long fingers. "It was his hands," she said, "that had first attracted her." "You're growing old here, Jack." "You're not old enough." He pulled away. He began to cough. He lost control of the spasm. Suddenly, drops of his blood mingled with the water, fell upon the stain. She cupped some in her hand and then, as if carrying a treasure, she slipped back into the colour, folding herself down until she had merged with it entirely. By the time he had recovered himself, there was only a voice, an unintelligible shriek, a rapidly fading bellow as if she had made one last plea for him to follow. "Not man enough either, I guess." He had watched the rest of his blood until it mingled invisibly with the water. "Mon ange." Chapter 11. Pourquoi m'aimes-tu pas? He remained in a tree cabin above the stain for as long as the food she had stored lasted. She had prepared the place so that he might wait for her if she were absent. He forced himself to live there, praying that through this particular agony he might confront and perhaps even find a means of lifting his burden. But pain was not enough. He began to suspect that pain was not even worth pursuing. More than once he returned to the big stain and sat in the pirogue, looking down, trying to find some excuse, some rationale which would allow him a chance of paradise. But he could not. All he had left to him was a partial truth. He felt that if he lost that, he lost all hope of grace. Eventually, he abandoned the cabin and the colour and made his way up the trace to Nashville, where he played an endless succession of reckless games until at last, as fighting broke out in the streets between rival guilds of musician assassins, he managed to get on a military train to Memphis before the worst of the devastation. At the Van Beek Hotel in Memphis, he bathed and smoked a guitar and, through familiar luxuries, sought to evade the memories of the colour swamp. He took the Etoile down to Natchez, well ahead of the Holocaust, and then there was nowhere to go but the Terminal Cafe, where he could sit and watch Boudreaux Ramzadine perform his idiosyncratic measures on the dance floor, his woman partners flocking like delicate birds about a graceful bull. As their little feet stepped in and around the uncertain outlines of an infinite number of walls, floors, ceilings, and roofs, expertly holding their metaphysical balance even as they grinned and whooped to the remorseless melodies of the fiddles, accordion, and tambourines, Jack Karakwazian would come to sense that only when he lost interest in his own damaged self-esteem would he begin to know hope of release. Then, unexpectedly, like a visitation, Ox Berger, a prosthesis better than the original on his arm, sought Mr. Karakwazian out at the main table and stood looking at him across the flatboard, its dimensions roiling, shimmering and cross-flashing within the depths of its singular machinery and said with calm respect, "I believe you owe me a game, sir." Jack Harakwasian looked as if a coughing fit would take control of him, but he straightened up, his eyes and muscles sharply delineated against a paling skin, and said with courtesy, almost with warmth, "I believe I do, sir." They agreed on a boyhood favourite, Desdemona's Luck. The object was to arrive inevitably at a sequence of events in which, through the recreation of history from the age of the prophet, with particular emphasis on Venetian society at the appropriate time, Desdemona is inevitably and inadvertently responsible for the death of Othello and the reformation and conversion to Islam of Iago. The game, with a fundamentally simple result, the subtleties of its moves and the complexities of its subsets were famous. The object must be achieved elegantly and surprisingly, offering no clue to rival players as to the means. Novices trained on the short forms and learned to translate a relatively small number of human emotions and ambitions into the logical language of their choice. The requisite societies were created, together with individuals and the relevant subplots, then translated into symbolic form to be retranslated at the last moments of the game. These forms had to be understood and countered with rival mathematics to block attempts at producing the endgame and to produce one's own. One thoughtless simplification of the mathematics and the game was lost. Oxburger opened with a classic Mandelbrot gambit. For the following days, they played the long forms, sign for sign, commitment to commitment, formula for formula. The great classic flat game schemes, the logic and counter-logic of a 10-dimensional matrix, rivalrous metaphysics, a quasi-infinity held in a metre-long box in which they dabbled minds and fingers and ordered the fate of millions, claimed responsibility for the creation, the maintenance and sacrifice of whole semi-real races and civilizations, not to mention individuals, some of whom formed cryptic dependencies on an actuality they would never directly enjoy. And Oxburger played with grace, with irony and skill, which, lacking the experience and recklessness of Jack Harakwasian's style, could not in the end win, but showed the mettle of the player. As he wove his famous Faust web, which only Kalinda had ever been able to identify and counter, Jack Harakwasian developed a dawning respect for the big farmer who had chosen never to exploit a talent as great as the gambler's own. And in sharing this with his opponent, Oxburger achieved a profound act of forgiveness. For he released Mr. Harakwasian from his burden of self-disgust and let him imagine instead the actual character of the man he had wronged, and so understand the true nature of his sin. Jack Harakwasian was able to confront and repent, in dignified humility, his lie for what it had truly been. When the game was over, by mutual concession, the two men stood together on the edge of the fault, watching the riotous death of universes, and Mr. Harakwasian wondered now if all he lacked was courage. If perhaps the only way back to her was by way of the chaos which seduced him with its mighty and elaborate violence. But then as he stared into that university of dissolution, he knew that in losing his pride he had not, after all, lost his soul. And just as he knew that pride would never earn him the right to paradise, so he judged there was no road to heaven by way of hell. And he thanked Oxburger for his game and his charity. Now he planned, when he was ready, to make a final try at the trace, though he could not be sure that his will alone, without hers, would be sufficient to get him through a second time. Even should he succeed, he would have to find a way through the stain without her guidance. Mr. Harakwasian shook hands with his opponent. By providing this peculiar intimacy, this significant respect, Oxburger had done Mr. Harakwasian the favour not only of forgiving him, but of helping him to forgive himself. The gambler wished the map of the stain were his to pass on, but he knew that it had to be sought for, and only then would the lucky ones find it. As for Oxburger, He had satisfied his own conscience and required nothing else of Jack Caraquasian. When you take your journey, sir, I hope you find the strength to sustain yourself. Thanks to you, sir, says Jack Caraquasian. The olive intensity of his features, framed by the threatening madness of the Biloxi Fold, its vast walls of seething colour rising and falling. The Egyptian plays with anyone, black, white, red or yellow, who wants his kind of game. And the wilder he plays, the more he wins. Clever as a jackal, he lets his slender hands, his woman's hands, weave and flow within the 10 dimensions of his favourite flat game, and he is always happy to raise the psychic stakes. Yet there is no despair in him. Only his familiar agony remains, the old pain of frustrated love, sharper than ever, for now he understands how he failed Kalinda de Vero, and how he wounded her, and he knows that she will never again seek him out at the Terminal Cafe. You're looking better, Jack. Sam Oakenhurst has recovered from the Machinois' torments. Your old self. Jack Caraquasian deals 7 hands of poker. In his skin is the reflection of a million dying cultures given up to the pit long before their time. In his green eyes is a new kind of courtesy, coolly amiable in his silk and linen, his raven hair straight to his shoulders, his back firmly set against the howling triumph of Satan. He is content in the speculation that, for a few of his fellow souls at least, there may be some chance of paradise. I'm feeling it, Sam, he says. Corsairs of the Second Ether. Warwick Colvin Jr. Note, this serial can be read now or at any time the reader feels ready. The story so far. In common with most of the others who explore the Second Ether, Captain Wilhelmina Roberta Begg and the crew of the Now the Clouds Have Meaning are searching for Ko-O-Ko, the legendary lost universe, said to be the single naturally habitable location of its kind in the whole of the bizarre space-time continuum. Itself, the sole level of the multiverse, so far discovered, which is not wholly inimical to humankind. Humes have divided the multiverse into a number of planes or branches, or perhaps facets of a near-infinite prism, calling their own division the first ether, and those which we most frequently intersect, the second ether, third ether, and so on. Thus far, we have found only the second ether responsive to our logic and therefore navigable, though legends abound of captains like Aisha von Abdul, who found a means of sailing through the third and 19th facets to discover paradise, and determined that it should never be corrupted, by the crazed Sinonauts that roamed the burst fractals and twisted reality folds of the initial circuits, forever bathed in a spectrum of unimaginable and unreproducible light. Alone, Captain Billy Bob Begg has tested the million roads one by one and imprinted herself with a map of the multiverse only she will ever be able to read. She is the greatest of the so-called chaos engineers who, using the principles of self-similarity, pilot their peculiar craft up and down the scales. They call this process folding, a kind of blossoming movement which enables their ships to progress in a series of folds in which they lock scale with a number of prescribed multiversal levels. Actually, as Professor Pop, Captain Billy Bob's deputy, explains, we are dissipating and concentrating mass and ratio to size and so on. We can go upscale or downscale, and if we upscale for 205 calibrations or folds, we reach, if we're lucky, the wonder of the second ether. Opposed to the chaos engineers is the dominant culture, known as the Singularity, which is bent on taming the second ether and conquering Ko-O-Ko, the lost universe. The Singularity has discovered a method of hard warping which allows its ships to drop through the multifaceted planes of the multiverse and emerge, if they are lucky, in the second ether. It is believed by some that the power of the Singularity to put its stamp on chaos is so considerable that the second ether, in some odd way, scales herself to its laws. Rather than adapting, as do other travellers, to the sometimes whimsical conditions of chaos, the singularity imposes its own reality. The only power great enough to challenge the natural order of creation, the singularity, is, in the eyes of most intelligences, the personification of pure evil, an instrument of the original insect. While Old Reg, first voice of the singularity, is Satan incarnate. As both groups of Humes continue to search for Ko-O-Ko, the lost universe, this great clash of philosophies is fought largely within the relative stillness of the second ether, that quasi-infinity of pearly rainbows, millennia of light years, long and curtains of violent, jewelish colour rising like sudden walls ahead or behind. The slogan of the wild-eyed chaos engineers who cruise the second ether for adventure, curiosity and massive profit is ride with the tide, while the voice of their opponents bellows forever that the singularity must hold, one refuses to fold. So clever are these mad creatures, arrogant enough to defy the fundamental logic of the multiverse, that they have built themselves a kind of false universe in which to dwell, enclosed within a vast, stabilized crystal of carbon, woven to infinite strength and able to resist the combined power of the multiverse. The singularity is not merely defiant, it is determined to triumph. To it, chaos is anathema, threatening the ultimate destruction of all Humes. Each individual unit of the singularity sees it as its duty to aid in the conquest of chaos, yet equally the multiverse, chaotic and swift to adapt to any threat, shifts, multiplies and modifies so rapidly that the status quo can never entirely be broken, though sometimes the balance might tilt first to the singularity, next to chaos, so radically that it might seem that one had conquered at last. Yet it is never so. The two philosophies will war for eternity, or else be reconciled. Reconciliation is ever the hope of the chaos engineers, but the idea is utterly loathsome to all units of the singularity. While the bleak metaphysics of the singularity, never better represented than in the person of her bravest ether traveller, Captain Horace Quelch, and his ship, the Linear B, permits only victory, chaos, rich with choice and tolerance, accepts and respects all philosophies, perceiving codependent variety to represent the true nature of the multiverse. The chaos engineers, that great family of freebooters, normally only connected through their communication systems, have noted a step up in the singularity's impositions, while areas of the second ether are being colonized. The search for Ko-O-Ko, the lost universe, has become more intense. During their mutual adventuring in the infamous Field of Saffron, Captain Billy Bob learns, via Captain Quelch, that the singularity has begun to fall away from our gravity, ripping horribly through the layers of the multiverse, pulled together by some other force or by its own unnatural weight they cannot tell. The fact is, as Captain Quelch admits, it has become crucial for the singularity to colonize and dominate the second ether. During an enforced sojourn upon Earth, core world of the singularity, young Mandy Begg learns that Captain Quelch and his supporters are fighting a new tendency amongst their own kind, for the lure of isolation is very strong amongst their doubters. While the ethic of the pure singularity is victory or noble death, Captain Quelch still represents the dominant faction which demands the total conquest of the second ether. Against these powerful centralists, Captain Billy Bob Begg and her crew of crazed solipsippers, high on super distilled carbons, and craving for curious experience, swear loyalty to the Great Mood, whom they worship, and pledge themselves to the freeing of the second ether from these unnatural and perhaps cancerous intrusions. Escaping at last from the quasi-universe, the singularity calls the statement of truth. Captain Begg and her bucko busters are unable to stop the process as their ship, now the clouds have meaning, goes into rogue fold, scaling up towards infinity and a kind of death, though to these brave souls that is no more than a welcome reunion with the Great Mood itself. Meanwhile, the I don't want to go to Chelsea and the Plum Blossom Local captained by Raider Miles of the Gulf Star and My Chin Tolly, respectively, have emerged safely into home scale above the main Martian scaling station, which had held entry into twilight, when Mars is a little more hospitable to chaos engineers not used to the stomach-turning bleakness of raw singularity, only to find, contrary to all agreements, that the statement of truth quasi-universe has engulfed the first ether and has ordered their capture. In attempting to backfold without coordinates, the Plum Blossom local irredeemably dissipates, while the I don't want to go to Chelsea escapes with the evil news that the chaos engineers have lost a chief attractor. The struggle has ceased to be wholly metaphysical. Meanwhile, with the groaning, sweating innards of a singularity ship, definitely Sagittarius, little Ripoldo Beg has crucial news of old Reg's next plan. Creeping through corridors, whose every massive seam appears perpetually at bursting point, listening to the deep distress of the bulging bulkheads, little Ripoldo searches for a communications room with the ship's captain, Mrs. Croner, concentrates on her relationship with Dungo, her partner. I am weary, she says, of your dismissive mockery. The ship falls relentlessly towards the second ether. At last, little Ripoldo comes upon the communications room, only to discover Mrs. Croner dead on the floor, the rejected posy of ratweed and lady's fist telling the whole story. On the screen, another tragedy manifests itself. Now read on. Chapter 97, Scale Sickness Again. As universes, scale upon scale, formed and reformed, dissolved and redissolved behind them, at a rate suggesting they must ride this fractal up to infinity before they could ever hope to be reunited entirely with the great mood, the famous chaos engineers gathered around their revered main type. Far gone, said Captain Billy Bob, a tear or two in her distant eye. It's a flat tire, I think, sweethearts. But they were swift to deny it. You were always a lucky captain until now, dear main type, said Pegarm Pete with an awkward slap to her shoulder, all obsidian carapace these days. And you're still lucky, Weirdo Pine. He had long since ceased to question the intensity of his love for the captain. Fast agreement, the other engineers rushed to confirm. This is how we learn if the music goes round and round, or, if not, where it comes out. Corporal Organ raised her granitesque head in a massive gesture of joy, her wide, wide eyes steady on the front screens and the great shimmering black and yellow globe appearing just at the moment it disappeared, at the next scale behind them. But oh, despaired Captain Billy Bob, this looks unending. My instruments, have you spoken to them recently? There was no cheering her. She insisted she had failed them. Chapter 98, Codependency Theories Aft. Captain Quelch had yet to experience the exhilaration he had expected to accompany his old enemy's defeat. Yet defeated she surely was, and with the greatest of the Chaos Captains blown to infinity, there would be no stopping the Singularity's holy expansion into the second ether. If, like Lucifer, he was prepared to defy the definitive logic of the universe, he expected the securities of Lucifer, a knowledge that the Singularity was in control forever. Now the others must think twice before pursuing their perverse adventures and celebrations. He died of a busted bladder, ma'am. I told him not to take that last bottle of port. He wasn't exactly a gent, if you know what I mean. Ubi bene, ibi patria. Captain Quelch swung in his brochette, his eyes full of mild and faraway madness. As they say, Mama Singh ignored him, her anxieties involved, as always, the efficiency of their weapons. My crown is a crown of feathers formed from the rarest of lights, the scarcest of spectra, I am trapped in the power of a devastatingly unimaginative political and academic orthodoxy, and because the orthodoxy is so powerful, no one in it will listen to the truth. They deny the very orthodoxy they worship. There is no addressing them. I need new weapons, but will they listen? Each unit is lost in their ownness. Always a noted paradox of the singularity which it, of course, furiously denies. Paradox is an obscenity which cannot be permitted in any part of its philosophy. She sights aggressively at the sweating metal of their walls, the in-bulging plates, the refolded rivets threatening to burst into the control room, the greenish steams and vivid gases, and everything moaning and squealing in protest at this unnatural means of progress through the multiverse, drowning the boom-booms of Africana Tom's dreadful disco sound as the pale disciplinarian bougies in the comforting shadows of the big oven. He, at any rate, is relishing some sort of victory. Captain Quelch, comes the voice of Roman Romanescu from the bells. Has anyone seen my antique manual? There's something boiling on the E-line, and I don't think we have the shot to suit it. Well, exactly my point, squeaks Ma Ma Singh, astonished by this confirmation and glad as a bell. I have an ally I know in you, dear Roman Romanescu. We need new weapons. She shudders her bronze and copper quills, her pleasure out of all proportion. And it is as well Roman Romanescu has no vision on this, only the delicious sounds. So he wets his lips. More and better weapons, good Ma Ma. Smarter, warmer, kinder weapons. Mommy boom booms, suck suck. She is cackling with delight, taking some control of herself as she hurries on the downshaft. What sublime decision. What male-y ways. Chapter 99. Phone outs at last. They have lost their main fractal and are off scale. They claim this is under control, but old Reg knows it means the destruction of their whole quasi-universe and the first ether with it. Perhaps, added little Rapoldo into the dolly's mouth, the second ether also. I heard this from the first voice itself, old Reg. He was at last communicating with wire ears of the pulsing blood, in a crisis of her own involving Capricorn Schultz, a half-hume banker to the homeboy Tong, who had attached himself freehand to the outer folds and made it impossible to drive anywhere but downscale. Even at the dolly, little Rapoldo could hear some of the mathematical obscenities yelled by the half-hume through the ship's marrow, not to mention the other stuff. Little Rapoldo felt bile rise in his throat. I, a half-skimling, half-hume, comb my spikes, lick my tips, taste my flumes. F farping parentheses Z equals Z farping squared, and squeezed like a whopper. Everyone had heard how Capricorn Schultz, the half-hume, had single-handedly climbed 500,000 scale fields and countless textures to spread his brilliant blue wings against the hazy serenity of the second ether. He disdained all protection and lived entirely upon his own twisted wits, using skimling techniques to hitch rides through the scale fields. Or so he claimed, for no Hume had ever set eyes on a skimling. SOS the Chaos Engineers! SOS the Chaos Engineers! The cry went out across the ether as wire ears sought help for herself and little Rapoldo. We're heading out to where the ether's silvery white, lit by the light of countless galaxies, the farping very hub of the multiverse, and the best and most dangerous, believe me, juicy pals, gateway directly into the second ether. I know. I am Capricorn Schultz, banker to the homeboy Tong. There is no more respectable voice in the multiverse. Didn't you ever wonder what mainlining was really all about? Pretty bodies? Pretty bodies. Oh, we'll tittle together in that fold away from fold. I am it, and I am more than it. SOS the Chaos Engineers. What's to do, Cap'n? Demands the ever-cheerful Stow Loon. More grub for the hands, is it? Or must we be lean for what's a-comin'? He smells a storm as fast as any other old second ether hand, and he squares up reluctantly, for he believes he's too old to weather another like the last one. Hell's glaciers! There's a slim chance yet for the balance to correct herself, but I can't seem to get back onto the crew. Are they frozen already? Captain Otherley says this was nowt to a Yorkshireman when he was a boy. In the days when buggery Otherley ran things like a cacatron. But is he rattled? Maybe, thinks the youngest hand, Monkey Girl, who hopes she will soon settle down. It is her duty to keep the gardens at peace. She had done so for gone 15 years, and the pulsing blood had always responded well to her harmonies. But with the onset of Capricorn Schultz, the gardens were showing signs of restlessness, and it would take little to send these vibrations throughout every fold of the great old-fashioned bloomer as she made her stately way up the scales. Captain Otherley readily admits he lets his ship fall towards a mirage attractor, the most feared phenomenon in the multiverse, and that only this put them in the power of the legendary banker, whose greatest strength lay in his pseudo-reality weaving. Yet he was damned if he wasn't going to try and get out of the trap in spite of the filth pouring everywhere into the ship from Schultz's bark box. Try them with some more Mozart. And if that doesn't give them the last of your messiaen, he tells Monkey Girl, it's all we can do now. And he throws himself deep into his brass legs, a brave smile on his big face as the massive prosthenics hiss in union with the flesh. Captain Otherley's ready to give that half-human bastard a run for his money. To be continued. And that's the end of part one.